The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello my friends, it's Sarah the Tudor Travel Guide here, and welcome back to another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. I'm looking forward to broadcasting to you wherever you are in the world, from here, in the heart of the Cotswolds in Gloucestershire. Now, of course, spring is well and truly springing here in the Northern Hemisphere. It's so wonderful to see all the lovely daffodils and spring flowers. And indeed, last week we really had a taste of the summer to come with some glorious weather that happened to coincide with my trip to Monmouthshire in South East Wales. Now, if you follow me on Instagram, you will have seen my travels to the likes of Chepstow and Raglan Castle. And I hope you enjoyed that and it provided a little bit of inspiration for your own travel agenda. Because of course, I know here we are at the beginning of April. Next month, May, is one of the most popular months for people visiting the UK who are interested in Tudor history. Of course, we have a very important anniversary coming up with the execution of Anne Boleyn. And I know from your emails, your letters, that you have trips in the offing for May. And for all of those of you who are planning, then I hope you're looking forward to your trip and I hope you continue to find sources of inspiration across the Tudor Travel Guide content. Do remember that if you are new to this show, then you can not only find some glorious places to visit here, but I also have my blog, which is www.thetudortravelguide.com, and of course my YouTube channel, which goes by The Tudor Travel Guide. And across all my platforms, including my social media on Instagram, you can find lots of different wonderful Tudor places to go and visit. And I try to bring you all the hard to find details you need to know to make the very most of your time on the road and to allow you to immerse yourself as deeply as possible in our Tudor past. Now, while we're talking about social media and Instagram in particular, I also just wanted to give a little shout out to a regular live room that I do with two of my blogging friends. That's Philippa from British History Tours and Deb Royal from the Tudor Times on Friday afternoon. So that happens at 4 p.m. UK time, and it is a room called Visiting Tudor Britain, and we try to bring you again more travel inspiration and tips and insights to a range of different places around the UK. And sometimes we even do those rooms, those live broadcasts from on location, such as we did when I was down at Raglan Castle, and in fact Philippa was just down the road at Chepstow. So it's a lot of fun, and if you have chance to join us, then please do. But of course, all of those lives do get recorded, and you would be able to find them on one of our channels. We rotate the rooms on a weekly basis. So that's just a little shout out for our live weekly Instagram room, Visiting Tudor Britain. Also, just a reminder that I choose not to run adverts on this show, but the show is kept on the road by your support. I have a patron program, and I would like to thank all of those patrons who currently support my work by donating month in, month out. Thank you so much. Your support is truly and deeply appreciated. And if you enjoy these shows and would like to consider supporting my work and keeping the show on the road, then all you need to do is head over to the Podbean homepage, and in the top right-hand corner you will see Become a Patron button. And there's all sorts of levels of sponsorship starting at just $1 a month. The programme is not yet fully subscribed, so if you'd like to support me, then I would be deeply appreciative. The final bit of housekeeping that I'd like to share with you before we get on with today's show is the fact that at the end of May, in fact Saturday the 28th of May, I am going to be running a masterclass with my friend and fellow blogger Philippa Brule from British History Tours. Now both of us get lots of messages, whether it's on Instagram or email, asking for ideas and for help in planning Tudor road trips, particularly to London. Questions like, where should I go? What do I need to see? I've got so many days available. What could I do with that time? What's the easiest way to get around? How do you use a tube? All of these types of questions. And so Philippa and I thought that we would put together a masterclass on that very topic. And so we are doing just that, Tudor London Made Easy, which is your essential guide to visiting the UK's capital. And we're going to be running that over 2 or 3 hours on Saturday, the 28th of May. Now, booking is not yet open, but I wanted to give you guys a shout out. So perhaps if you are interested, either if you're rather immediately planning a trip or you have one in your sights and you want to know all the important information of how to get around London, how to save time and money from two people who have visited London on many occasions, then make sure you put a note in your diary and I will be letting folk know via obviously my email list when registration opens. So that's another reminder, folks. If you are not yet on my mailing list, then it would be a good idea to sign up. And you can subscribe via my homepage. Again, just the email address for that is www.thetudortravelguide.com and just hit the subscribe button. And at the same time, you will receive your own free guide as a thank you and a welcome for joining the Tudor Travel Guide community. Okay, my friends, I think that is all the housekeeping done for today and we are ready to get on with the show. So in the summer of last year, I travelled down to London to visit a place which I'd only recently become aware of, and that's Sutton House in Hackney. Now, in truth, I had heard of Sutton House before, but I hadn't truly appreciated how unique this particular location was. And it was delightful to go and tour the house with our guide, and you will meet her, of course, Jo Nightingale. And she was able to tell us all about this incredible survivor, which is truly unique because I think it's one of the few places, a few Tudor courtiers' house that still survives from the early Henrician age, owned by a young and aspiring and ultimately a very successful Tudor courtier by the name of Ralph Sadler. So, in this particular podcast, you'll be going on a tour of the house, hearing about its history, and also a little about the life story of our elegant Sir Ralph. Well, strap yourself in, folks, because we're about to go time travelling. Let's go over to Sutton House and meet our guide. Well, here I am in Hackney and at Sutton House in Hackney, and it's a place that I've wanted to come to for such a long time because I think it's associated with one of the most fascinating characters of the certainly early Tudor period. In fact, he had a very long life, as my guide here is going to explain to me. And I just wanted therefore to say hello, Jo. Thank you so much for welcoming me to Sutton House today.
Hi, really glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for being our guide. We're going to be learning, of course, about the history of the house here and also its Tudor owner, or one of its Tudor owners, Ralph Sadler. But before we do that, perhaps you could just tell us what you do here at Sutton House.
Yeah, sure. I'm the visitor experience officer here, job shared with a colleague. And we both give tours to the public 3 days a week of the house and look after other aspects of the visitor experience of coming here. And I also look after communications to publicise the house and let people know that we're here.
Okay, lovely. Perfect person to be speaking to. Well, thank you for coming in. We have the house to ourselves, so I'm really looking forward to this. Now, I thought it would be interesting just to start by talking about Hackney in the Tudor period, because I've driven in this morning from the Midlands, and of course,
within the M25, which is our orbital that goes around London, it's pretty much built up all the way. I mean, we are in a very built up part of London, but of course Hackney wasn't always like that. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about Tudor Hackney, what it looked like and kind of who came to live here and why?
Yeah, well, it certainly looked very different to the way it looks today. People are always surprised when I show them a model that we have here of what Hackney looked like around 1535, which is the time that Sutton House was built. And it was very, very rural. We were just starting to see the first signs of some cultivation, with some fields starting to be ploughed and used to grow local fruit and vegetables. And a few courtiers and merchants were starting to build houses here. And that was really a trend that continued over the next couple of hundred years, and the area gradually became more and more built up, particularly after the railways came. But at the Tudor period, it certainly was a really rural area and a desirable retreat from central London.
Yeah, and so quite as you were indicating, we're looking at a model you have here of Tudor Hackney. So it really is very helpful to help you understand the context of the building of the house we're in now. So we might be fast forwarding slightly, but I just wanted to flag up for those people who aren't aware that Ralph Sadler was a protege of Thomas Cromwell. And Thomas Cromwell, of course, had a place in Stepney, which is not too far away from here, but just to give people an idea of the sort of the relative distances between those two villages, which is what they were at the time. How far away is that?
Not far at all. I'd say about a mile and a half, something like that.
Oh, so really, I mean, you know, and I think that's important, isn't it? When you think about the fact that, and I'm sure we're going to talk more about this, but Ralph Sadler became quite an important part of Thomas Cromwell's household, that they were able to move backwards and forwards quite easily between those two houses.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure that was an influence in Ralph deciding to build his house here.
I'm sure it must have been. And just for those of you who don't know, I recently wrote a blog about Thomas Cromwell's great place at Stepney. And if you haven't read that, but you're interested in doing so, then as ever, there will be a link in the description below. And it's probably worth saying we're going to be taking some photos while we're here today. And so those photos too will be in our show notes, and you'll get a link in the description. Well, thank you for that. Now, on this model, I can see, I can see Brick Place as it was originally known. Can you tell us a little bit about the house itself and when it was built?
Yeah, this is Brick Place. We can see it on the model. It was built in 1535, took a couple of years to build. And we see on the model that it was one of just a handful of houses, really, in Hackney at that time, and also the largest one. So it was immediately a sign of status by virtue of being the largest house and also being built from brick. And the reason it got that name of Brick Place, it's a kind of an informal name really that was given to it, was because it was so unusual at that time for someone to be building a house in brick. And I always think that Ralph was trying to show his status and that he was somebody to take notice of, in that he was using what was seen as quite a pioneering material as opposed to the wattle and daub and timber of other Tudor houses. So he would have been surrounded here by a handful of other courtiers, possibly the odd merchant, and it did later become a very popular area for merchants. And St. Augustine's Church would have been his nearest parish church, which is very close by. And the tower of that is still there today, as along with a couple of other landmarks, like some of the road layouts are still recognisable from that time.
Yeah, so I was driving in and I saw the parish church. I said, oh, we must be close. I can see the church, and indeed it is. Now, next to this model, which shows us Tudor Hackney, you actually have a specific model of the house itself. So, yeah, maybe you could describe what we can see here and what we know of the kind of size, scale and layout of Sutton House.
Yeah, we do have another model to try and show how the house would have looked when it was built, because it has been altered a little bit over the years, although maybe not as much as you might expect in 500 years. We're standing looking at the back of the model now, and that is fairly unaltered really, although there was a later addition by a Victorian church institute. But the big difference is that we see on the model that the house had quite a formal garden, which would have been used for a combination of recreation and more practical purposes, like growing vegetables and herbs for medicine making. And we're lucky that we still have the well outside the back door of the house, but the rest of that land was sold off at some point, and there's a Victorian school there now at the back of the house. And the other big difference is the front elevation of the house, which had a Georgian makeover in 1741. And that hid what we see on this model, which is a kind of gabled roof and the smaller, very typical Tudor windows, which were replaced by Georgian windows. So although the actual layout didn't alter much, the appearance did, and that can give the impression that the house is a bit newer than it is.
Mm. And so when you see it today, you are struck mostly by its Georgian facade, but there is a little bit of the diapering pattern and red brick, isn't there, on one of the wings that just gives a glimpse of its Tudor origins.
Yeah, there is, and there's more of that in our courtyard, so maybe if we have a look at that, I can point out a few other features.
Shall we do that now?
Yeah,
let's go outside. So we're going out of the doorway. It's a lovely door. I don't know what age this door is. Is it a later one?
I think it probably is original. There have been a few Victorian additions because they were quite keen to restore the house to it, some of its Tudor splendour. It's not always easy to tell which is which.
But we're in a really cute little courtyard now, aren't we?
Yeah.
It's sort of bedecked with a fantastic wisteria and some gorgeous. Over to my left, there's a fabulous looking Tudor window that has survived. But yes, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what we might see of the Tudor house here?
Yeah, I would like to point out some things like the gabled roof, which is visible from the back, because that's a clear sign that this is a Tudor house, along with the chimney stack, which is original and made from these very narrow Tudor bricks, apart from the very top, which was restored when the National Trust opened the house about 30 years ago. And the layout of the house becomes a bit more apparent from here as well. It was built on quite a typical Tudor H plan. So there was a central area, the middle of the H, which would originally have had a great hall, but that was actually lost during the Georgian period because they did split the house into two properties. And we ended up with two front doors and two entrance halls, partially taking up the space of that great hall. But it's nice to be able to see where that would have been. And as you say, we also have the Tudor window, the only original window remaining in the house after the Georgian makeover. And that's actually known as the Armada window. You probably know it was quite fashionable for people to claim that they had something from the Spanish Armada after that period, either some furniture or a fitting in their house. And I think that idea persisted around that window for quite a long period, possibly a few hundred years. We've kind of spoilt it a little bit with modern carbon dating techniques because we now know that that window is pretty much the same age as the house, so it's likely to be an original window, whereas the Spanish Armada was a good few decades later. So,
well, I must admit, I'm rather glad that it's an original
exactly,
window
yeah.
and not a later one. But
yeah.
And that's lovely. I mean, it's a beautiful lattice type shape, you know, and then square window. And I can imagine it. Once I see that window, I can then imagine it dotted around in the rest of the courtyard.
Exactly, yeah. We think that one escaped because there was probably some kind of shed or lean-to covering it up when the Georgian makeover happened, so they didn't bother to replace that one. And obviously we're really glad that they didn't.
Absolutely, what a quirk of fate, that's amazing. Now, directly behind me, I'm standing looking at what would have been the front range in the Great Hall, and directly behind me there is another building there now, but that, as you were pointing out, would have led out into the garden.
That's right, yes. This wing was only added in 1904. I'm not sure exactly when the land was sold off, but we do have a Victorian school behind it, which I think is a bit older, kind of late 1800s. So at some point that land was sold off, and that is where that formal garden would have been that we were discussing, yeah.
And is there any chance of seeing that Tudor well?
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to follow me. So it was built over when the National Trust restored the house and they revealed it. And now we only have the kind of the underground bit, the well itself. We don't have the above ground bit anymore,
yes.
Sadly. The wishing well element has gone at some point. But we can quite often hear the water flowing under there. The water level is quite high. And visitors to the house always like the fact that when they've seen it on the model, they can pass over it as they leave. So it's nice that we know that it's still there and we know where it was.
But it's a landmark, isn't it, that allows you to orientate yourself in space as well.
Exactly,
and kind
yeah.
of get a feel for where the rest of the garden. So as you say, once you've seen the model, it's like, ah, okay, right, that's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lovely. Okay, so we're going to continue our exploration of the house on the ground floor. Mm-hmm. So where would you like to take us next?
Yeah, I'll take you into one of our more important rooms that has a bit of design significance. Bear with me.
I must admit, I just feel that there's such a lovely energy in here. It's a real warmth. And although I know the National Trust has owned this, I think you were telling me from the 1930s, it kind of feels as though the people have been living here all the time. It's got a very felt lived-in sense.
Yeah, it's always been very used. It wasn't actually opened by the National Trust until 30 years ago, although they did own it from the run-up to the Second World War. But it was used as offices for quite a long period. And it was actually lived in again by squatters in the early 1980s, and they felt very at home here. I've actually seen footage of young families living here in the early 1980s.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it is a property that has kind of welcomed people in, and people have really kind of felt at home. And the trade union, who had an office in here from the 1950s, actually stayed for 30 years, so they obviously felt very relaxed here.
Now, you said have an office in here because you brought me into a spectacular room. And I say spectacular because it's lined with this glorious, I guess, oak linen fold panelling with your very typical Tudor fireplace, your Tudor arch, with slightly warm, but nevertheless, you can see the carving and in the engraving which has embellished it. So where are we now in this house, and what would have been used for in Ralph Sadler's day?
So this is the linen fold parlour, so-called because of the panelling, which we're surrounded by, which has this intricate linen fold design carved into it, and it is made of oak. And we believe that this would have been Ralph's office of sorts when the house was first built. He would have used this room to receive some of his colleagues and to show off his status to some extent, I think. And that's a use that the room has had through the years. Various other people from the second resident, John Matchell, the wool merchant, right through to Clive Jenkins, the leader of the ASTMS trade union, used this room as an office. And I think it has a real, quite commanding atmosphere to it, and people liked to capitalise on that. But that's very much associated with the linen fold panelling, which is throughout the room. And quite interestingly, I think, this panelling is slightly older than the house, which suggests it came from another house and was moved in here probably by a later resident rather than having been here when Ralph Sadler first built the house.
Okay. So are you talking about the actual panelling here or the room as a whole?
The panelling.
Just the interior decoration.
That's
so
right.
The room, the space would have been part of the original house.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And you may not know this, Jo, but listeners will know that I have a very vivid imagination. So as you're talking, I'm just seeing Ralph Sadler sweep in out of the corner of my eye, clutching a load of papers, putting them on the desk. And who knows who he was talking to in here? I wonder if Cromwell was actually in here at one stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite likely. It's rumoured that both Cromwell and Henry VIII visited Ralph Sadler here at the house. So, yeah, the mind does boggle as to who might have accommodated.
You've set the hairs on the back of my neck just standing up. It's very, very atmospheric. Wonderful. We need to know about the architectural features of this room.
I think we're particularly lucky to still have this panelling. I mean, a lot of this linen fold panelling was wiped out by the Great Fire of London. So the only remaining examples in London are ours, the one at Hampton Court Palace, and the panelling at Westminster Abbey. So we're in really good company still having this panelling. And particularly given the fact that it was actually stolen in the early 1980s.
Oh, really? The whole lot?
That's right, yeah. The house was empty for a period in the early 80s while the National Trust was working out what to do next with it. And some guys pulled up outside in a van, marched in here, bold as brass, posing as workmen, and prized it off the walls and just walked out with it. But I think
that's amazing.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I'm so grateful that we got it back. But I think it's its scarcity that actually brought it back to us, because they didn't take it very far. They apparently only offered it to a yard in Shoreditch, which is just down the road from here. And it was recognised because it is such an unusual style of panelling in London now. So thankfully, the dealer it was offered to made the thieves quite a low offer for it, and then got in touch with the National Trust and we got it back.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's fabulous. And I'm also amazed it wasn't damaged more. You know, you can imagine they must have done that fairly quickly in terms of prizing it off the walls.
Yeah, that it has been restored. The whole house was restored in the early 1990s. So I'm not sure exactly what condition it was in before that, but certainly it's been possible to restore it to a very good condition, and it has a great feel now, doesn't it? And you might notice that we have a couple of hinged panels in the panelling, which open to reveal some painted sections on the wall behind, very much in the same style as the panelling itself, the same kind of size of linen fold, but painted in three colours, green, cream and red, which I believe the actual panelling itself would originally have been as well.
Ah, so the panelling would have been painted, so it would have been much more, because we're so used to, aren't we, seeing the plain oak, and we kind of think that's stylish and classy, but of course that's not how the Tudors liked their interiors. They like things to be bright, quite bright and
gaudy. Exactly, yeah.
Our tastes, at least.
That's right. So yes, I believe so, that the panelling would all have been painted, and these painted versions, this kind of trompe d'oeil version that we see behind these hinged panels, it's a bit of a mystery. We don't really know why. Clearly there was a painted section on the wall at one point rather than actual panelling. But it may be that this panelling, being very labour intensive to produce and very expensive to buy, was installed in stages. Yeah. And originally there was a part that was painted in, and it would have blended in at the time with the painted panels. Yeah. Or maybe there was just some furniture there originally and they didn't think it was worth the expense of panelling the entire wall. Or even just to show how it would look, it may have been painted on, although that feels like quite a modern idea. So we don't know for sure, but it's quite intriguing.
Yeah.
And that would have been covered up probably until the Victorians were here and discovered it.
Well, fabulous. Well, thank you so much for showing this linen fold room. Where do we go to next to continue our story?
We'll go up the painted staircase, which was installed by John Millward in the 1620s, and up to the Great Chamber.
A very significant room in the house.
Absolutely, yeah. Particularly now we don't have the Great Hall, it's really good for showing people how these social spaces would have been used.
I love all the creaky floorboards. Fantastic.
I know, yeah.
There's a house with character.
They're really wide floorboards as well, aren't they?
Okay, so we've come into a bright, airy, quite large room. Oak panelled again, but a different type of sort of more plain oak panelling. So where, you said the Great Chamber, so maybe you could tell us about that and the story of this room.
Yeah, it was a very social space, and it was a kind of follow-on room from the Great Hall, which would have been below us. So parties visiting Ralph Sadler and his wife Helen would have had the savoury courses of the banquet that they would have been given in the Great Hall below us. And then they would have withdrawn to this room for the sweet courses, and then later pushed any furniture aside and used this room for dancing and merrymaking
into
the early hours. So it was kind of the party room of the house in a way. And if we have a look under the floor, we have a bit of a giveaway to that. There are joists running in both directions under this floor.
Yes.
Which are the original Tudor joists. And that is one of the indications that this room was always built for a large number of people and probably for dancing.
Ah.
And it's essentially got a strengthened floor like a nightclub would have these days.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You've just lifted a plank of the floors. And,
yes.
And now I can see inside. So we're like seeing in the innards of the old Tudor floor and the old Tudor planking. So really, those people you mentioned, potentially Cromwell and Henry VIII, they almost certainly would have been in this room if they'd been entertained by Ralph Sadler. They must have come up here and been here.
Yeah, it seems very likely. This is one of the main social spaces of the house. And I always feel that he built what are effectively mini staterooms, really, to give him that opportunity to invite the great and the good and to show that he was somebody to take notice of. Because he did have this amazing career with this whole series of important roles that really started around the time that he was living in this house.
Yeah, and it's really not, we're not far from central London. I know when I was writing about Stepney, you know, it struck me that you, on a horse, you could be out here in 20 minutes or so, you know, from the city of London.
Yeah.
So really very easy for people who were living in the city or based in the city to come out here and be entertained. And quite an intimate space, I would have thought. I would have thought it'd be quite nice to come along and have a sort of a private dinner with your host, and you wouldn't be bringing the whole court. It would be a much smaller number of people here.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. But I do think he wanted to show off to some extent that he was somebody on the up, and that by holding those kind of events, he was setting himself up as somebody to take notice of. I mean, we know that he was very closely involved in the dissolution of the monasteries, which started to happen just the year after this house was built.
And actually, I think this is a great time to talk a little bit more about Ralph. About who was this man? What was his history? How did he become to be associated with Cromwell? And kind of what happened to his career?
Actually grew up in the house of Thomas Cromwell. Accounts seem to vary as to when he moved in there, but sometime between the age of 7 and 14, depending on what account you read, he moved into Thomas Cromwell's house. And he grew up as a kind of ward of Cromwell, learned various skills, languages, learned about the law from Cromwell. And I think from that early point, Cromwell wanted to set him up on the road to almost following his own career path. So he was very close to Cromwell until the point, of course, that Cromwell fell from Henry VIII's favour and was thrown into the Tower and eventually executed. But actually, that's when Ralph's career really started to take off.
I think that was the same for some of his other circle as well, like Sir Richard Rich, for example. But tell me, I mean, unlike Sir Richard Rich, who seemed to have gleefully thrown Cromwell to the wolves and testified against him, I get the feeling when I read about Ralph Savile that he remained quite loyal to him, and he certainly didn't do anything to precipitate or encourage Cromwell's downfall. Is that right?
That's my understanding, yes. And I think he did try and take action against some of the people involved in the plot against him as well. But also at the same time, he managed to disassociate himself from Cromwell sufficiently that he was actually given one of Cromwell's key roles as Secretary of State after Cromwell's execution. And he was knighted by Henry VIII at the point that Cromwell was executed. So although he was actually thrown into the Tower at the same time as Cromwell as one of his close associates, he was quickly released and did quickly bounce back from that. And that makes me feel that he must have managed to disassociate himself quite successfully as well.
Yeah, very fine line to walk there, wasn't it? But he was recognised, as you say, by Henry VIII for his talents and taken into the Henry VIII service. But I think what's remarkable about Ralph is that his career certainly didn't end with Henry VIII. He went on to serve every Tudor monarch.
That's right.
Yeah, so maybe you could just tell us a couple of the highlights of his later career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Henry VIII valued him enough to make him part of his Regency Council, which helped Edward VI govern when he was king from the ages of 9 to 15. So that was obviously a very powerful and significant position. He was then one of the cohort supporting Lady Jane Grey and the bid to keep a Protestant on the throne. Of course, that didn't succeed for very long. But again, I always think that he must have been either very lucky or very clever in the way that he disassociated himself from Lady Jane Grey when she was eventually overthrown. And although he had to lie low during Mary's reign, he didn't fall victim to Bloody Mary's sweeping through the land, getting rid of all of these Protestants who had been overthrowing her beloved Catholicism. He just really had to stay out of the way until she was out of the picture. And then when she died and Elizabeth I took the throne, obviously she was Protestant again, and Ralph was able to bounce back, and he took up some of the roles that he'd had under Henry and Edward, such as Privy Councillor. He was also an ambassador for her to France and Scotland, and he was her jailer of Mary, Queen of Scots, when Mary fled to England, eventually signing Mary's death warrant.
And that, just for those people who don't know, I believe that he looked after at Wingfield Manor in Tutbury Castle. And actually, he had his knuckles wrapped for giving her a bit too much freedom and allowing her to go hawking too much. I think it was maybe Cecil who wrote the letter going, you know, what do you think you're doing? Get it back under control.
Yeah, that's my understanding, that he was a very lenient jailer. But he was one of the party who eventually signed her death warrant. So I don't know how difficult he might have found that.
So, Jo, my understanding is that Ralph Sadler was born in Hackney. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, his father had moved here before his birth.
But he sold the house here, the Brick Place, when? And then what happened to him? Where did he go to live?
He stayed here for about 11 years. So he sold the house in 1546. And he was an MP among all his other roles, including for Hertfordshire. So at that point, he did move out into Hertfordshire. And I suppose he was going onward and upward in the world. He wanted a bigger property and, again, to show his status and be close to the community that he was representing.
Did he build a much bigger house there or move into one? I don't know. I mean, I don't know either.
No, I don't know much about that myself. I know that he wanted to increase the size of his property. So I would imagine it was less of a mini manor like this is and more of a kind of full country house.
A country seat.
Yes. And if I'm right, he's buried in Standon in Hertfordshire in the parish church.
I believe so, yeah.
He died when?
He lived to be 80, and I think that's really significant for any Tudor, really, but particularly for one who served under Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, who were lobbing people's heads off if they got the chance.
He reminds me a bit of William Paulet, first Marquess of Winchester, who lived to a similarly old age and ascribed his success to being more like a willow than an oak, i.e. bending to the political whims of the time and the monarch. Sounds like Ralph Sadler might have had a bit of that about him as well.
I think he absolutely did, yeah. I imagine him to have been quite a charming man because of the way he bounced back from these various pitfalls.
Yes.
But also, I think he must have been quite clever and maybe a bit manipulative, but it's all speculation. But he certainly did have another incident while he lived in this house, which was a real threat to his career, but he did, again, bounce back from. That was in his personal life. He'd married Helen, who I mentioned, having met her in Thomas Cromwell's house. And she had previously been married, but her husband had disappeared and was assumed dead. And although Thomas Cromwell and others advised Ralph against marrying her because she was actually working for him as a laundress after her husband had disappeared, they'd fallen in love. And to Ralph's credit, he married her for love. And they built this house together and had 7 children. But about 11 years after their marriage, the original husband, a chap called Matthew Barr, actually reappeared. Oh, and it turned out that he wasn't dead.
Oh, Lord.
He'd been fighting in Ireland, and I think it was easy to assume that he had died there. But also, he was a known gambler and a drinker, so it's quite likely that he might have been running away from some kind of difficult fracas or gambling situation. And maybe he even heard about how well Ralph Sadler was doing and decided this was quite an opportune moment to make a reappearance. But he popped up, and you can imagine that was a real scandal at that time. Divorce and annulment was such a new idea, and you know, it was one thing for a king to do them, but it certainly wasn't something that everybody was doing. And so it looked to a lot of people as if Ralph had married somebody who wasn't available to marry. It was a bigamous wedding, and they'd had 7 illegitimate children. And for a man in Ralph's position, this was a real threat to his position. But also it was his career that enabled him to get out of it, really. Because being an MP and also somebody very influential at court, he was able to have an Act of Parliament passed privately, which was never actually read out in the House, to say that if a woman had been deserted by her husband for 7 years or more, she was considered free to remarry. And that's actually still the grounds for desertion law.
I was going to say, wow, yeah, that's amazing.
It is, yeah.
How so fantastic. I never realised that.
Yeah, that Ralph was involved in something that still resonates to this day, along with the dissolution of the monasteries, really. So it did dent his reputation, and you know, maybe he would have flown even higher if it hadn't been for that incident. But he managed to bounce back from it. They had to have the children legitimised, but otherwise they were able to carry on and have this long marriage until, you know, Ralph lived to be 80 years old, so it didn't impact his life
too
much.
He managed to get through that. He really ducked and dived, didn't he, along the way, and came out as a real survivor. I suppose, you know, the question I have about his life is the role in the dissolution of the monasteries. Obviously, being one of Cromwell's right-hand men, his principal secretary, obviously was going to be involved in that. Do we know anything specifically about his role in the dissolution?
Well, he was the man on the ground actually going to many of the monasteries and abbeys and overseeing, you know, a lot of what we think of as a kind of ransacking and destruction of those monasteries. Of course, they viewed it slightly differently and felt that they were on a mission to remove this source of corruption. And there were certain cases in which he did gain property from that. St. Leonard's Abbey, the grounds of that were given to him. I'm not sure exactly how many individual abbeys and monasteries he was involved in, but he was involved in on a kind of practical basis in making that happen.
Great. Well, that's a fascinating story. As I say, the more I learn about Ralph Sadler, the more I want to know. He sounds like an amazing man, and I would love to have had dinner with him here.
Absolutely.
In his great chamber and heard some really amazing stories, I imagine. Anyway, where do we need to go from here, do you think, Jo?
Well, we're standing in the central section of the house, and either side of us are the two wings, the two sides of the H shape of the house, which on this floor contained Ralph and Helen's chambers. And I always think that seems a bit odd that they had effectively their bedrooms either side of this very social space, but actually the chambers were used in quite a different way at that time to we would use bedrooms now. So maybe we should go through into one of them and have a chat about that.
Yes, so we're heading into the corner of the room through a couple of, it's like a double door, huge, heavy oak doors. Gorgeous. And we're into a much smaller room, more intimate, but again, it's furnished with plain oak panelling and some lovely, lovely oak furniture and the usual gorgeous Tudor fireplace. Some fantastic carving. Is this marble?
It's stone, I think.
Stone. It looks, has a marbling effect on it.
Yeah, I think that's the remains of the painted pattern at the top there, which has faded over the centuries. Yeah, but it is the original fireplace.
And do we know anything about this particular coat of arms?
Well, being the original fireplace, I would imagine that's associated with the Sadlers, but no, I don't know in any detail what that represents.
Fantastic. So tell us about this room, Jo. What went on in here? You said it was a bedroom.
Yeah, we believe this was probably Helen's chamber. And yes, that did mean that it was her bedroom, but it had a lot of other functions as well. She would have received her visitors in here, surrounded by her female servants in the way that we sometimes see in TV dramas and that kind of thing. But also with her servants, she would have carried out a lot of household tasks in here. She would have received her children in here for lessons, particularly the girls. And we believe that they were taught some basic reading, writing and arithmetic, along with household and medicine making type tasks. And she gave birth to several of the children in here as well and raised them. So it was a very diverse space. It was her living quarters as well as her bedroom. And so that's why it's maybe not quite as surprising as it seems to us that it was directly adjacent to the Great Chamber.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess these windows here would have at one time looked over some lovely countryside.
Absolutely, yeah. But of course, they would have been the original Tudor windows, whereas now we're looking at the Georgian replacements.
And a very busy road outside.
Yeah, absolutely. So the outlook has changed a bit, but the Tudor windows would have made this room, it's cosy anyway, and I think it would have felt quite kind of inward looking in a way with the Tudor windows. And the panelling, which we see in here, which we found evidence that this was painted red at one time. So that would have made the room feel even more intimate, I think.
Absolutely. Warm, really warm. Imagine the fire in the grate. And oh, lovely. So I just wanted to ask you, was there any other room associated with this room?
No, not a room. There was a ladder staircase in the corner of the room, which led down to Ralph Sadler's office in the room below.
Oh, so there was a direct connection between the two.
That's right. And at that time, that was the only way between the floors on this side of the house. We came up what's now known as the painted staircase, but that was added in the 1620s. So originally there was just this ladder staircase, which I always find it really hard to imagine the Tudors navigating in the outfits that they were in at the time, but I suppose they would have been very used to that.
So a ladder staircase being just a straight, fairly narrow wooden staircase, is that what you mean by that?
I think that it would have been the kind of thing that we might see going up to an attic, you know, a kind of sloping ladder on a slight diagonal, that's what I'm imagining.
Yes, yeah. And was there a similar arrangement over, because as you said, we were standing in the main centre of the house, we have two wings on either side, Helen's chamber on this particular side. I think you're going to tell me that Ralph's chamber was on the other side. So was there a similar connecting arrangement between the first and ground floors there?
Yes, there was some kind of Tudor staircase, which has now been replaced by a Georgian staircase. So we don't know exactly what that looked like. It's likely to have been the staircase that the servants would have used because they were more concentrated on that side of the house. And all we have remaining of it now is a lintel. So we just have to use our imagination as to what that might have looked like.
Yes, right. Lovely. Well, perhaps we could go over and have a look at what remains of Ralph's bedroom.
Absolutely.
That would be fantastic. It's a very different room.
It is.
It's clearly done out in a different style. Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, well, much later on, this room was occupied by a Victorian solicitor called Charles Pulley from 1822. And he lived in this side of the house for 40 years. So we use this space now to show how he might have lived. And it's decorated in much more of an early Victorian style because he used this room as his study. But we do believe that it was Ralph Sadler's chamber originally. And one of the clues to that is just behind you where there's an open door.
Yes.
And you can see through into an intriguing little area there.
I can see through into here. It's a very small area, as you can probably hear by the changing acoustics to my voice. So what went on in here, Jo?
Well, that space was only discovered when the National Trust restored the house 30 years ago. And it's actually a guardrobe or an ensuite toilet, basically, which dates right back to the building of the house. So quite amazingly, I think Ralph Sadler would have had an ensuite loo, which is what suggests that this was probably his chamber.
Yeah.
And I think, again, that's a sign of his status. It would have been quite a rare thing to have that. And also probably of the kind of guests that he was expecting to receive at the house. If we think that the chamber was a living room and a quarter for inviting guests as well as sleeping, then it's possible that people like Thomas Cromwell and even Henry VIII, if he did visit, might have used that facility.
Well, yes, because often the principal room in the house was ceded, wasn't it, to the guest of higher status.
That's
or
right.
The honoured guest. Yeah, wonderful. Amazing. I love it. I love it in here. Do we know, actually, because this wasn't a moated house, was it?
No, it wasn't.
So often with guard robes, they discharged themselves into the moat. But I presume they just had kind of some kind of sewage pit that was cleared out regularly by the gong scourer, I think is the name for
That's
the person
right.
who does that.
That's right. We can actually still see it in the room below. There's a little cesspit. So it's not,
oh,
not
really?
A sophisticated toilet. It's a hole and a drop, really. But
yeah,
so it would have gone down into the cesspit below and then one of the servants would have emptied it
yeah.
from there.
Lovely. Yeah. Lovely job.
I know.
Absolutely
nice topic.
Gorgeous. Okay, so we're moving on. Where are we going? So this was where you said the original Tudor staircase would have been
that's right.
Used by the servants.
Yeah, what we see now is a Georgian staircase, which was added when the house was split in half in 1751 with these kind of barley twist banisters.
Mm.
But there would have been a Tudor staircase in this area, probably smaller than this one. And all that remains is a lintel, which we're just walking beside now.
Oh, yes, I see. You've got it nicely signposted. So you can see lintel, chamfered. Lintel chamfered to provide headroom for steep original Tudor staircase. Oh, so it's on an angle, isn't it? So
yeah.
You think that it was coming sort of straight up to the next floor, I see.
Yeah, the layout was somewhat different at that point. We're about to go into the Tudor kitchen, and we know that that was originally a bit larger than it now is. So the wall that I'm standing behind would have been slightly further out, and the staircase would have somehow slotted in beside that. Yeah.
So really the kitchens, as you say, we're about to go into the kitchens. It could have been at least another couple of foot longer than
yeah.
the kitchen we see today. Because, you know, compared to some great houses, this kitchen is quite dinky, isn't it?
It is, yeah, for the size of the house. I suppose they would have done some of the food preparation in the Great Hall as well. So the fact that we've lost that is slightly misleading in terms of people assume that everything was done in this kitchen, but I think there would have been a few rooms involved. But it's not huge. And actually it did have some later uses, which has meant it's been reconfigured a little bit. As you can see in some of the brickwork, there are various mismatched areas of brick. But we've stripped the walls back to the brick and tried to reinstate how we think it would have looked when it was a Tudor kitchen, just to give an impression really of how it would have been used at that time.
Yeah, so it's a lovely lintel over the fireplace with the pots hanging there. And again, you can imagine the fire and the bubble and the smell going on in here. Lovely. Good. Now, obviously, you said that Ralph left this place, Brick Place, as it was then known, back in the mid-16th century, and it's had a long life from that point forward. Perhaps you could just briefly tell us about some of the incarnations and how this house is used today.
Yeah, I mean, it has a lot of history, this house, but I'll try and pick out a few highlights. It was a merchant's home for the next 100-150 years. And then it was a school as early as 1657, actually, Mrs. Freeman's School for Girls, which was quite pioneering at a time that Hackney was actually becoming known for girls' education. And that continued for a couple of hundred years with another school in here in the Victorian period, about 1841. A bit later in the Victorian period, the whole house was reunited after having been split and used as a residence by the Georgians. And it was then used as a church institute for the local St. John's Church, which we referred to. And that was for the development of young men, really, to give them skills training, help them get into trades, hobbies and pastimes. They actually used the Great Chamber as a billiards room, which I can really imagine with its panelling. And after that, eventually it passed to the National Trust in 1938. But that was obviously quite a period of pressure for the National Trust. Lots of big country houses were coming in with the onset of the Second World War. And really opening up a smaller house like this in an inner city area was probably not really something that was on their agenda at that point. So they tried to find uses for it so it could be preserved but be sustainable, basically. And after the war, it did become an office, largely for the trade union, the ASTMS, but also other voluntary and charitable organisations for about 30 years. Then the National Trust had to try and work out what to do next with it, because it needed quite a bit of restoration. And while it was empty, squatters moved into it for a couple of years.
Right.
And that was really the start of another chapter, because they opened the house up to community users. They started to hold all kinds of events and workshops here. And when they were eventually evicted, because they were holding quite a lot of late concerts and nightclub events, that set the pattern really for what would happen next, because the community were very keen to continue with the kind of events that were going on and to have access to Sutton House. So although the National Trust did actually toy with selling the house at the end of the 1980s, because they didn't really have the funds to restore it, they were eventually persuaded that they needed to do so and to keep it open. And it opened eventually in 1994, from which time we've really tried to keep it going with all kinds of community activities, as well as being open as a historical site. So we use it for learning activities, social and cultural events. We have weddings here, and of course we're open, as we've said, for guided tours as well. So it has a really diverse set of uses these days, a bit more than a typical National Trust house.
Really, very diverse, absolutely. Now, there's one thing I'd really like you to show me, and that's really, I suppose, Sutton House in popular culture, because Hilary Mantel, I believe, visited here when she was first researching Wolf Hall. Of course, Wolf Hall is all about the Tudor world through Thomas Cromwell's eyes. So not surprising she came here, but I think there's something in the cellar that you might have that might be of interest related to that. Could you show me?
Yeah, that's right. We actually held an open day here before the house was open to the public, and the cellar was one of the areas that we were able to open. And we had a display there about brick making. So we can go and have a look at that, because we still have some of the articles from it.
Lovely. The story of the brick that we're going to see has become quite famous, I think, and it inspired Hilary, didn't it, to write a certain, a minor character, but character nevertheless, into the story. And maybe you could just tell us about that, and indeed show me the brick.
Yeah, you're right. We're in the cellar now, and we have a whole display in here which we largely use with school groups to tell them about brick making and how it was an innovation in Hackney when this house was built. And we have some examples of Tudor bricks that have been discovered, loose ones that we're able to use in the display. And one of them has a footprint of presumably a Tudor dog in it. And that's one of the things that apparently really captured Hilary Mantel's imagination when she came to Sutton House for one of our open days during the period that we were restoring it. And there's actually a really nice article on the Guardian's website about her visits and how she was inspired. And she said that she could really sense the house as it would have been when Anne Boleyn was on the throne and Ralph Sadler was living here, and it inspired her to try and bring those people to life again.
I can see that completely. I've found my imagination has been running wild while you've been talking, and I've been seeing all sorts of ghostly figures coming and going around us as we've been talking, getting on with the business of daily life. And what we see here is one of the bricks with this Tudor paw print. I think this looks like kind of a wolfhound of some description. It's quite a big paw print, isn't it?
And
ladies and gentlemen, as ever, this will be one of the pictures that I include in the show notes. So if you want to have a look at the very brick that Hilary Mantel looked at and helped spark her imagination when she was writing with Wolf Hall, then pop on over to the show notes and a link will be in the description. Whew. Well, that was just a brilliant tour of the house. I so enjoyed that. Thank you so much. We're back out almost where we started, back out in the courtyard. And before we go, I just wanted to ask if you could let people know how they can find out more information about the house, and if they want to visit, what do they need to know, particularly in these kind of COVID, post-COVID times?
Yeah, absolutely. We're just open for guided tours at the moment. So the best thing to do is to have a look at the National Trust website and look up Sutton House on there. We have our own area within the website. And that will tell you a bit about the history of the house, but also how to book a guided tour, which is currently on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. And that will be with myself or my colleague Sam.
Well, you might get to meet Jo if you come along, ladies and gentlemen. So I really urge you to do so, because I think this is one of the finest examples of a courtier's house that I've seen. And I think it really, it's very atmospheric. There's a real energy about the place. So I think it should be a must on any Tudor time traveller's itinerary. Well, that just remains for me to say thank you so much for showing us around today.
Thank you for coming.
Before we finish the show, remember, you can support my work via my Patreon programme, where various levels of sponsorship are available, starting at just $1 a month. Check out all the details of how to become a patron in the link included with this podcast. Oh, and don't forget, you can be part of my closed Facebook group, where fellow time travellers like you hang out with me and each other to share some of our favourite things about visiting the UK. From great Tudor places to visit, to the best way to take your cream tea in an afternoon. From the latest travel news to the traditional Sunday roast. So don't miss out, and you can apply to join by clicking on the link in the description. So now it's back to close the show. Well, I hope you enjoyed your tour of Sutton House as much as I did. You've had a flavour for its uniqueness, and I hope that you can get to visit it one day. Now, of course, Hackney lies north of central London, but you can get to Hackney on the Underground, on the Tube, so it would be fairly easy to get to if you were visiting the City of London. So I hope it makes it onto your itinerary. And now you also may want to note that unfortunately Jo is no longer a guide at Sutton House, but I'm sure that if you go you'll be meeting one of her wonderful colleagues, and you too will be able to deeply immerse yourself in the past and in the world of Ralph Sadler and his mentor Thomas Cromwell. Okay, my friends, well, it's just a reminder, of course, as ever, to make sure if you want to be kept up to date with everything that's going on at the Tudor Travel Guide, do subscribe to my blog via www.thetudortravelguide.com. The links are all in the description below. And of course, I have lots of up and coming road trips. And if you want to follow me live as they unfold, then it is best to do so by following me on Instagram. And again, you could just search for the Tudor Travel Guide and I'm sure you'll find me there. I would love to see you there. And feel free, of course, to DM me with any of your questions or your comments. All right, well, next month I will return with another on-location adventure, and I'm also going to be sharing something with you that's quite special. Very recently, there was a new album released. This is a musical homage to the life of Catherine of Aragon, composed by the talented Jeff Proudley. Now, a couple of my patrons have already received one of those CDs as a gift for sponsoring the show, but I wanted to bring some of his music into the Tudor History and Travel Show so you can taste it for yourself. I love these musicals that are created around some of the well-known Tudor characters. Of course, we had Boleyn the musical that you heard a lot of on this show last year, and now we have the pleasure of diving into the world of Catherine of Aragon. So if you are a Catherine of Aragon fan, this will be just for you, and make sure that you tune in again next month. Okay, that definitely is all for me. So wherever you are in the world, I hope you are well and safe. I look forward to welcoming you on the virtual road again soon. Okay, bye for now.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.